Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, the best horror movie of 2019. We asked 500,000 horror fans online what their favorite or best horror movie choice for 2019 was, and we're here with their answers and ours. The results of the voting were half surprising to me and half not. The movie I'm going to spend most of this episode talking about, I knew wasn't going to get very many votes. So, like, for context here, the winning movie, which was Dr. Sleep, got more than 1,000 votes. The movie that I'm going to talk about got less than 100. As a matter of fact, it was less than 50 the last time I counted. The posts are still alive, so maybe it's crept up a little bit, but it didn't get a lot of support, but the support it got was very thoughtful, so I thought that was cool. Now, the winners surprised me by quite a bit, because Dr. Sleep won by a mile going away. Midsommar barely got any support at all, which kind of frankly shocked me. I think of it as a divisive horror movie, but to be divisive, you got to have like half and half, like one side loving it, one side hating it, kind of like a Halloween 3 situation. And there was barely a twitch in the voting for Midsommar. The fact that Ready or Not came in second, I think is really cool, just because, well, we'll get into the why of it for a second, because I'm going to tell you what some of the people who voted for it said. And then in third place came Crawl, which was interesting. It's a movie that I did not like that much in terms of the characters. I really liked the atmosphere and the creatures. The characterization I thought was super lazy. So, but there's something really interesting that happened in the voting that made me really excited to record this episode, because a lot of the support for the movies that won had, you know, things to say, like they were entertaining or they were surprising or they were scary, etc. We'll get to that in a second. The movie I'm going to talk about didn't get many votes, like I mentioned, but it was the only one out of any of the voting that was getting comments like, I lost sleep over this movie. This movie fucked with my head in a big way. I still haven't recovered from seeing this movie. I really like when a horror movie gets comments like this. It feels like the movie reached out of the screen a little bit and like threw a punch and hit some of the audience. And I really like when that effect happens. So in the place where we ask this question, Nige Holstone responded, Dr. Sleep all day long. There were other good ones that year, but this was such a relief, a great sequel to The Shining that could have so easily gone the other way and fucked it. Tammy Porter said, I'm voting for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I might be alone in this. It wasn't necessarily the scariest, but I think it was overall most entertaining. It brought me back to my childhood and the ghost stories we would tell. Tristan Clark voted for Dr. Sleep and said, a horror masterpiece and a momentous achievement by pleasing both fans of the King novel and the Kubrick film simultaneously. Interesting reason to respect it. China Andronicus said, I absolutely love Ready or Not. Samara Weaving was, as always, fabulous, and the ending was completely unexpected. Jeremy Powers said, not saying it was the best, but I did quite enjoy Escape Room. It was very similar to Saw, and each room was very interesting and unique. Kept me intrigued on how they were going to escape each room. Dr. Sleep was a pretty solid follow-up to The Shining as well. So from those comments, you can get the feel for the kind of support that these movies were getting. Not surprising. They were being judged on, were they fun? Were they scary? Were they entertaining? Were they surprising? Etc. Now, check out the comments that Jordan Peele's movie Us got. Nicole said, Us scared me deeply, still creeps me out, had me feeling weird for weeks. A bunch of people commented under her vote saying, I feel the same. Tracy said the movie was so well done that I was an unfunctional mess for weeks afterwards. You were not alone. David said, I think the thing I enjoy most about Jordan Peele movies is that you can actually see this being true in some sort of way. Tracy said, because I got so creeped out during my first viewing of Us, I had to pause the movie, leave the room, and compose myself before putting it back on. That's only happened to me twice, and I'm a diehard horror movie fan. Dave said, Us is American poetry at its finest. Amazing concept that just leaks into our understanding as the movie progresses. When exposition is a horrifying release instead of tedious filler, you know it's special. So if you compare those to the kind of comments the other movies were getting, you can get a real feel for how a lot of the viewers of Us were rattled or deeply unsettled. And honestly, I was rattled and deeply unsettled by the trailer that came out before Us was released. I think it's one of the great horror movie trailers of all time. And I, in marketing for a living, and also a diehard horror fan, so I've seen a lot of trailers and studied a lot of them. I don't say this lightly. That trailer was a masterpiece. And it gave so much of the movie away in advance. But because the movie is so weirdly constructed, there was just no way to guess how it was being given away in the trailer. I think Jordan Peele loves to do fuckery in right in the open where you can't see it. Kind of like the way he snuck the alien in Nope onto the poster. But I was badly wrong about Us. I hated this movie when I saw it in the theater. And I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I am interested for the listeners out there. Does this happen to you a lot? Yeah, it's happening to me, I don't know, maybe once or twice a year now with horror movies, where, not to this extent, I think this is the biggest, fastest swing a movie has made in my affection that I can ever remember. But does this happen to you where, like, you change your mind massively on a horror movie? And it could go either direction, right? Hate it at first and then end up loving it, or love it at first and then end up thinking, wow, what was I thinking, when you go back and look at it months or years later. And my problem with the movie on my first viewing in the theater was it's a gorgeously made, shot movie, incredible acting. So I was really into it. Until the fake, like, and by the way, there's going to be tons of spoilers here for Us, so you've been warned. But the fake science plot. So, like, the science plot in Get Out really worked. It was this procedure that clearly isn't real and doesn't exist, but you can, like, soul swap or brain swap or whatever is technically going on in Get Out. And it can be done, like, on an estate with some equipment, right? And it's like an evil thing that you could do, but it's on a very manageable scale. The movie Us was asking the viewers to believe that there was this massive science experiment. As far as I understand it, Us is a very complicated, very strange movie in its plotting. So, like, I'm just going to take my best stab here, but The Tethered seemed to be the result of a mass experiment gone wrong and abandoned. And the fact that every human being in America was copied, left underground, and that this secret never got out, and that the people who ran the experiment thought it was a good idea to just not clean up any of this and just leave everybody underground. Not even that far underground. I mean, when Adelaide, the switch happens, she doesn't really have far to go to get up into human society and, like, claim a victim, right? And I got so taken out of enjoying the movie by getting stuck on this plot point that it just detonated the whole experience for me. I couldn't get back into the film. I was so angry. And then I wasn't in the mindset or the mood to be receptive to the Hands Across America thing, which is a lot to swallow plot-wise as well. Although I ended up thinking it was genius, and we're going to talk about it. But Anyway, I hated it. And I guess it should have been a sign to me that I wasn't done with the movie, that I stood outside the theater and just argued with a friend for hours, as I've mentioned before on this podcast, because even with movies that I hate, on my first experience, I don't want to spend hours talking about something I hate. I want to move on. And this was a long discussion with a lot of facets to it. And that should have been a sign to me that this movie had had an impact and was going to dig deep and not let me go. And this movie has not let me go. It has become a mini obsession. So let's get into why Jordan Peele's Us is the best horror movie of 2019 and maybe beyond. So I'm a huge fan, as like a horror junkie, of discovering little horror mini genres, right? There's one that's emerging now, which I kind of think of as like the influencer horror genre. I mean, Shudder's influencer show is obviously one of those things, but like Bodies, Bodies, Bodies had an element of this. Deadstream, We're All Going to the World's Fair. There's going to be a lot more entries in the horror movies based on what influencers do mini subgenre. But Us is firmly planted in a subgenre I never gave, or mini genre I never gave a lot of thought to, which is the doppelganger movie genre. So I was trying to search to see if there were lists. There aren't many because it's a very small genre. But the list I found from Film School Rejects blew my mind, because when you find a list about genres like zombies in the snow genre, right? Most of the movies on there are either going to be less than great or so bad they're good kind of movies. The doppelganger horror genre is apparently just all masterpieces. Like, honestly, if you just gave me a bunch of money and made me a horror director, I think I would make a doppelganger horror movie. They can't miss. So check out this list real quick. At number 10, I can't even imagine a list where this masterpiece is number 10 going down to one. But number 10 is Possession, 1981, an incredible movie. Number 9 is Coherence. Number 8 is Cam from 2018, which I think is a really underloved movie. I loved Cam, watched it twice. Number 7 is Lost Highway, which I think is my personal favorite of the David Lynch movies that deserve more love. Number 6 is Body Double. Number 5 is Vertigo. Number 4 is Mulholland Drive, which is routinely on movie lists as the greatest movie of the last 50 years. Number 3 is Annihilation, which to me is, I really admire a lot of what Annihilation did, but I was frankly bored by a lot of it. So, but I think it's a really, really well done movie. Number 2 is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And number 1 is The Thing. This is an amazing group of movies. One of the very few movies that I could honestly say like kind of changed my life is the movie The Double Life of Veronique, also a doppelganger movie, although not really horror, though it does have horrifying things happening in it. So one reason that Us is a masterpiece is that it's a doppelganger movie, and apparently they're all masterpieces. The next thing is that Jordan Peele is fucking with us, right? Like I said before. First of all, let's start with A Tale of Two Shirts, right? There are two important shirts in this movie. One being worn by a fake Adelaide, one being worn by a real Adelaide. At various times, they switch. That's part of like the most important thing that happens in the plot. One of them is a Michael Jackson Thriller t-shirt. And one of them is a Hands Across America shirt. Now, let's just get out of the way for those who haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while. The key thing that happened here, right? So there's a mirror group of people who live underground. One of the funniest things about Us is the very opening shot has a TV showing a commercial for Hands Across America. And there's VHS tapes on the side. And one of them is Chud. A cult classic horror movie, and CHUD is an acronym that stands for Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers. So Jordan Peele was literally telling us what was happening in the movie before the movie was even a minute old. But little Adelaide, the girl in this movie who grows up to be Lupita Nyong'o, she goes with her family to an amusement park. As a matter of fact, Jordan Peele is such a horror movie lover. I feel like he doesn't get any credit for this for some reason, at least inside a lot of the horror community I spend my time and watch. Like, there's so many cool. There's a moment at near the beginning of Us where they're at the music park, and the Adelaide's mom says they're shooting a movie just over the way a little bit, and because it's Santa Cruz, it's Lost Boys. Clearly, is what they're shooting. But they go to an amusement park. Adelaide's father is neglectful, lets her wander off. She ends up in a hall of mirrors and is taken down and dragged into an underground lair by fake Adelaide, her mirror image, who switches shirts with her, takes off the Thriller shirt that her dad just won for her in a game, by the way, which was number 11. 11 is going to be a big number for this movie, but it was the number 11 prize. Puts on the Thriller shirt and puts her Hands Across of America shirt on the real Adelaide and leaves her underground handcuffed to a bed. She then ascends and is taken in by the family thinking it's the real Adelaide, but a switch has happened, which we don't find out until the very end of the movie. And it's an absolutely incredible twist that I did not see coming at all. And at the very end, when Jason, Adelaide's son, is staring at her suspiciously, now just now figuring out that his mom is a monster. She's one of the untethered who did all of this, switched and ruined the other person's life. I shouldn't say monster because there's complexity to this. But anyway, the point is, he's figuring out that she's not who that the family thought she was. And Adelaide, fake Adelaide, gives a really, really sinister, creepy smile. And it's almost the last image of the movie. But it makes me laugh so much in retrospect because of the Thriller shirt, right? How does the Thriller music video end? Think about it for a second. That last image of Michael Jackson, who with the contact lenses, right? And we know is walking off with his girlfriend who thinks everything's fine and he's like an evil infiltrator. The shirt was telling us how it was prophesizing the end of this movie from the jump. Just incredible filmmaking. And the Hands Across America shirts that ends up on the real Adelaide, who's now the only person in the untethered who can talk. The rest of the untethered can basically only grunt and make noises. She conceives of this revolution, this revolutionary statement where the tethered rise up all at once from the underground. They untether themselves by killing a lot of their copies. And then they stage a new, incredibly creepy Hands Across America, which is how the movie leaves us. And it's to make a statement. And then who knows what revolutionary Adelaide had planned next, or if the untethered are going to even do it. The original real Hands Across America only lasted for 15 minutes, which is weirdly the exact amount of time it took the Adelaides to get switched out at the beginning of the movie. So now that the Untethered's leader is dead at the end of the movie, do they have more plans sketched out? What happens after Hands Across America, if anything? Or did Revolution Adelaide just want to make a statement and not care about what came after and it would just organically play out? Who knows? But here's the thing. The one I'm calling fake Adelaide, Revolutionary Adelaide, she has a real point, right? Like, you're stuck underground as carbon copies, mirror images of people who are living full lives on the surface. And you don't get a full life underground. When they get to be on the roller coaster above ground, you have to like mimic the motions just standing in an empty room. They get to have great meals and you get to just eat rabbits over and over and over again. This is a massively unfair setup, completely unequal. So for her to want to strike back is natural. Calling fake Adelaide the villain of this movie is like calling King Kong the villain of King Kong, or calling Carrie White the villain of Carrie. Now, granted, little Adelaide, the untethered Adelaide, the tethered Adelaide, she looked incredibly creepy doing it. She definitely looked villainous. But calling her a villain is super reductive and doesn't really get us very far. So now you have this person who causes this uprising, right? And then at the end, she gets fully infiltrated into the family. Only Jason really suspects, I think. Gabe and Zora don't seem to suspect. And honestly, Gabe and Zora really teamed up through the course of this movie. And they were kind of like holding down the ambulance area and figuring things out on their own while Adelaide and Jason were dealing with Red and the rest of the tethered. So they might just be their own unit now and not care. And at the end of this movie, we are just riding off with the quote unquote villain at the wheel, with the driver's wheel in her hand. And Hands Across America Part 2 taking place across the country as the credits roll. So who are you rooting against and for at the end of this movie is my question, right? Like, once I fully realized what was going on in this movie, I didn't have anyone to root against at all. Like, I liked all of the family. I understood all of what the tethered were doing. So where's the bad people? Sure, there have been some massacres. The massacre of Tim Heidegger and Elizabeth Moss's family was one of the best sequences and scariest sequences and also most hilarious sequences in the whole film. But just like with human beings on the surface, there are clearly some over-the-top tethereds and some not, right? I'm going to have to watch it again because I'm not even sure that the Jeremiah 11 guy was murdered. He might have died of natural causes. He sure as hell was old and looking dire by the time we rejoined him at the end of the movie. So the thing is, Jordan Peele is fucking with us. He has given us an incredibly scary horror movie with possibly no villains. And if there are villains, they're us. Like, everyone's equally compromised. There's just no way to make them a villain without making ourselves the villains at the same time. He's fucking with us in the same way John Carpenter fucked with us at the end of The Thing, with the very ambiguous who knows kind of ending. He's fucking with us the way Hitchcock fucked with us in Psycho, taking out a very important character where the audience is absolutely not expecting it. He's fucking with us the same way Stanley Kubrick fucked with us when he unlocks the storage door that's keeping Jack Torrance trapped in The Shining. Like, who opened that door? Is it the hotel? Was it a particular ghost? Was it Grady? Was it Danny in a trance? Like, who knows? And now Jordan Peele, in an equally exquisite way, is doing the same kind of thing to his audience. This movie is entrapping you like a Venus flytrap. You can't really start thinking about who's bad and who's good in this movie without getting the movie all over you. And the tethered with their Michael Jackson obsession is such a tell, right? Was what a dual celebrity this turned out to be. Someone who brought absolute joy to millions and like memories that are incredible, almost unmatchable for pop stardom, but also someone with horrifying implications, which is why the tethered are all wearing one glove. and red suits, like the Thriller outfit. Jason, the good kid, backs his mirror image person, his double, named Pluto. And I love how all their names have to do with like darkness and shadows. Pluto's the king of the underworld. Umbre, who's the mirror image of Zora. Umbre is a root word for a shadow. So Jason backs his double into a fire and burns him alive, right? There is a touch of cruelty. When Umbre dies in a tree, she's got Lupita next to her just playing mother, but basically going and not doing anything to help her while she slowly, slowly, slowly dies out. Tim Heidecker and Elizabeth Moss's characters are not good to each other. They are super passive aggressive to each other. At the end, when Elizabeth Moss is just begging Tim Heidecker to get up, get out of his chair, do something, go investigate the noises outside, he blows her off in like a kind of cruel and evil way. They're taking shots at each other nonstop. They've given up on their dreams. You would think Winston Duke's character, Gabe, would be the most normal because he's the funniest, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. But he's also the catalyst for a lot that goes wrong in this movie. He's very pushy into getting Adelaide to go to this place near the beach that's traumatizing for her. He's oblivious. To dangerously oblivious to the things that are going on around him. He's offering the tethered money like bribes when it's well past the point that this is a bigger thing for them. This murderous spree they're going on is much more a passionate statement. And he's like, you know, I'll give you $100 to leave us alone. Like, who are the villains exactly in this movie? And who are the good people, or where are there any good people? Now, another thing that puts this movie in my choice for best horror movie of 2019 is if there's something transcendently good in a movie, or something that a director is transcendently good at, it usually means greatness is going to ensue. Like Quentin Tarantino is transcendently skilled at character dialogue, especially two characters a la Samuel Jackson and John Travolta just driving in a car on a way to a hit and a collect and dialoguing with each other, right? This is something that he's better at than like 99.9% of people who ever did it or maybe ever will do it. And Jordan Peele is transcendently good at music in movies. It's just no doubt. I've got 5 on it. I had no idea how perfectly that song would fit in a horror movie, right? Like once he puts it in the context of a horror movie, it's the biggest aha, oh my God, how did I not see that moment of all time? The switching from Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys into Fuck the Police in the massacre scene in Elizabeth Moss's house is both bone-chilling and just one of the funniest things that's ever happened in a horror film. But the thing that really sold me was the last song in Us, the Minnie Riperton song, Les Fleurs. What a breathtakingly beautiful, perfect, just unfathomably spot on choice for it's like haunting, slightly sinister, but also very peaceful. And since we leave the tethered at the end of the first phase of their plan, if there's any more to come, reenacting the Hands Across America thing, the fact that they're still, and we now have to absorb whatever that statement is and whatever we think next is coming and what the implications of all this that broke out were, that song playing over the beautiful landscape with the helicopters hovering and then going to the credits gave me chills. It gave me goosebumps the size of huge geese. Just an exquisite moment. And it kind of impossible to not get emotional at if you love movies. And you love skill. You love a perfect choice. It's like an absolutely beautiful chess combination. There's just nothing like the elegance of putting everything right into its place at exactly the right time in exactly the right manner. So Jordan Peele's Us is my choice for the greatest horror movie of 2019, primarily because it interacts with its audience. It's entertaining us is great. And like, there's a lot of horror movies and movies in general that don't entertain at all. So like getting that one thing right, that's good. But getting into your mind and getting into your heart and like making changes, doing edits on us, on what we believe and how we think and what we feel and what we expect to scare us versus what turns out actually to scare us that we didn't see coming. Absolutely incredible. So just the fact that it reaches out and rattles its audience is the most important thing. The fact that it's super memorable and just won't let you go, which is what it's done to me, I think that's getting way more than what I paid for in terms of lasting experience. It also has transcendently great things in it, like the music choices, like we said, like the crazy, like show off skills of planting Easter eggs right in front of us that give away the whole game, but we don't know it. Like the shirts and the VHS tapes and the astonishing fact that Adelaide is out of rhythm when she's snapping to the song that's we see in the trailer. And there's a fleeting glance of what the hell is going on here on Zora's face. Jason's into it. I don't know. Is Jason a tethered too? I don't even know if he got swapped out. But just hiding that stuff right in front of us. And then it all coming back like Usual Suspects style in your memory, in your mind after you watch the movie going, oh, my God, that. Oh, my God, that. The fact that it's got the world's creepiest mechanical owl in the Hall of Mirrors. I love this friggin' owl. It would be one of my favorite things to see in a haunt ever. I would die laughing. The crazy good cast, which we've talked about who they are. They're just all excellent actors. Although special shout out to Madison Curry, who played young Adelaide, and is a lot of the imagery of the trailer and the poster and like all includes her. And she didn't have a lot of time to get things done in this movie, and she's completely memorable. And the writing is also transcendently great. I think when we look back from some distance, one of the greatest and most important horror lines, single lines of dialogue delivered in a horror movie in the last 20 years, is going to turn out to be Gabe's line when the family, when the tethered are shadowy lined up in the driveway about to do the home invasion in their incredible creepy fashion, the way that the mirror image gauge just Gabe just charges straight ahead, the way Pluto takes off and goes up a tree. I don't even know what Umbre was doing. She's so fast, like absolutely terrifying. But the line when right before all hell breaks loose, when the quote unquote normal family is standing in the window looking out, and Gabe says, "What, you all are afraid of a family?" That line, it was perfect delivery. Yeah, go back and listen to the way Winston Duke delivers that line. Absolutely perfect delivery. Like a little bit of doubt in it, but like still, it doesn't make sense, right? Like there's no families aren't gonna show up in people's driveways and start serial killing them, right? So we think. But the fact that the family unit is the thing that is supposed to be the harmlessness signal, and the fact that the movie is positing that those family dynamics are, as much as anything else, what is bringing us down as a society and we should be terrified of, that building block of that a lot of the rest of the movie is built on, the what are you scared of a family notion, is just sheer genius. And the fact that Us is nested in an unbeatable genre, the doppelganger horror genre. Come on. So Us, just mind-blowingly good. Getting my vote 100%. I was wrong. I'll admit it previously. Changed my mind. Okay, before we go, I want to knock some dust off and polish up a hidden horror gem for you. I'm really excited about this one. So, as always with the hidden horror gems, I know there are so many knowledgeable fans of the genre who follow the Horror Weekly page and the podcast. So, if this is like super familiar to you, I apologize. I had never heard of it, and which is astounding because of who's in it, the circumstances of it, and the fact that I love classic black and white horror. I grew up watching classic black and white horror before I saw any of the modern horror. So the fact that I had no idea this existed is mind-boggling. It is the 1966 film Eye of the Devil. The cast on this film is ridiculous. It stars David Niven, Deborah Kerr, Sharon Tate in apparently her first feature film role, and David Hemmings. It's directed by J. Lee Thompson. We're going to get to this in a second. And it's based on a book called Day of the Arrow by Robin Estridge. So this is the cool part of this to me, is the way I discovered this movie existed was from a book. There's a publisher that I cannot recommend more called Valancourt Books. They do incredible reissues of old, like, kind of forgotten horror classics. So they're perfect for this hidden horror gems segment we like to do on this podcast. And the covers are gorgeous. The introductions are really insightful. They actually took up the Paperbacks from Hell series, which is like a semi-famous in the horror genre thing of the horror novels from like the 80s. That came like Fast and Furious all in a rush, just classic after classic after classic. So Valancourt threw the Day of the Arrow book on sale on Kindle. So I started reading reviews of it to see if it was worth it, because it's got a kind of an ugly cover. I like to buy the Valancourt books when I do physically. One, just I like physical books better. And also the covers are absolutely like just stellar. But this one had an ugly cover, so I was like, I don't care to own this physically. Maybe I should just download it. And in the reviews for the book, I discovered that a movie called Eye of the Devil had been based on the book. So I got the book, read it. It's magnificent. And then I got really intrigued. The movie, all I knew was the title of the movie. I didn't know the circumstances at all about it. And this movie is just... So it's a real like slow burner. I feel like I've never bothered to find out who created the A24 studio, but whoever created A24, I feel like maybe their pitch when they started the studio was just, nobody makes movies like Eye of the Devil anymore. We should just start a whole studio and make movies like this movie. Because this is like an A24 movie before A24. So if that's your style, like I really love this movie, but I have to admit, it's insanely edited. It's really grindingly slow in a couple parts, but it is one of the most gorgeous horror movies I've ever seen. I could watch this movie no sound and be entertained all the way through. It's just absolutely ravishing. The visuals are crazy good. The plot is interesting. Oh my God. I forgot. The cast is so good. I forgot. It's got Donald Pleasance as like a completely sinister priest. Oh my God. The fact that Donald Pleasance, it wasn't even the first thing to mention about this movie is astounding. So I love the movie. It is just a visual treat. It is not going to be for anyone who's like looking for nonstop excitement or whatever. But if you appreciate and enjoy the classics, you've got that going for it in spades. But there's a couple other things I would talk about real quick about this. So first of all, Sharon Tate is amazing in this movie. And there's a really sad now background video that's completely fascinating that was made during the making of Eye of the Devil. It's called All Eyes on Sharon Tate. So it's like a 10-minute-ish behind-the-scenes look at getting Sharon Tate up to speed for her first major feature role. You can tell, the people making the video can tell, everyone around can tell, that Sharon Tate is going to be a huge star. The video is like, it's like something that Quentin Tarantino would have created for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood if it didn't exist. It feels insanely like Quentin Tarantino wrote this, even though it's, you know, it's the other way around. This obviously influenced a lot of how Tarantino saw Sharon Tate. But it's, I love when I don't just find a horror movie that I end up really enjoying. I find it in conjunction with a book, which is fantastic. Gave me a great read, a good night of like slow burn British chills. And then a whole bunch of other like peripheral stuff, like this All Eyes on Sharon Tate video, which I watched twice because it was completely fascinating. So this movie was just the gift that kept on giving. And in that spirit, let me close with the director, because I have now found a new director that I can just completely fall in love with, because this man is insane. I can't even say that he's good necessarily, like based on this. He's obviously got a great eye. I think the thing I love about this guy the most is he just seems completely nuts and willing to try anything. So J. Lee Thompson directed Cape Fear, Guns of Navarone, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and this, Eye of the Devil. And the most astonishing thing is, one of my favorite slashers that I always fight for, did, you know, earlier in a different podcast episode for Horror Weekly, is 10 to Midnight, starring Charles Bronson. And that movie features a naked serial killer. And it is also insane. Like, when you're watching 10 to Midnight, I dare anyone to watch that movie and not at some point think, how did this movie get made at all? It is completely crazy. So, no surprise, it turns out, it's the work of J. Lee Thompson. So, I am now going to go track down. He made a movie. So I've seen all the movies that I named. I love Cape Fear. I like Planet of the Apes, although I like the modern Planet of the Apes so much that the old ones now, it's hard for me. But and I liked Guns of Navarone, of all things. But he did a movie called Ice Cold and Alex or something like that. So now I'm so excited to track this down and watch it and see if it's as crazy as the rest of his works. They interviewed, I think it's Robert Mitchum, some, maybe Gregory Peck, something like that, some big Hollywood star of the time, about, or they asked him about J. Lee Thompson, and he said that his, he said that J. Lee Thompson's work was formless, which doesn't sound like a compliment, but he was definitely saying it as a compliment. It was coming across in the interview like, I've worked with all these directors and they're all kind of like paint by numbers and they take the studio notes and they turn out like big Hollywood studio product, but they all kind of feel the same, look the same. And he's like, it's so refreshing to be with someone who just has no rules at all. And that formless word really stuck out because in both good and bad ways, that's what I think set Eye of the Devil apart as a viewing experience. It was not really trying to tell a linear story so much. It was definitely falling in love with its own visuals. but it could do things super effectively. There's this one scary scene where Sharon Tate is sort of hypnotizing, mesmerizing Deborah Kerr possibly to death. And the way it's shot, the way it's paced, the music behind it, the way it like turns up the tension on is this going to work or not? And then you definitely feel, even though you know that Deborah Kerr probably isn't going to die at this point in the movie, like only Psycho would do that. It's one of those magic moments where it just feels inevitable that she's going to die, that there's no way out of this situation that Sharon Tate is putting her in. And Sharon Tate is really menacing in this part. So I fucking love this movie for faults and all. And the fact that it gave me a book, other videos, other movies to track down, a new director to be in love with. I just can't be happier that that happened. So sorry to gush, but the hidden horror gem of the week is Eye of the Devil. If you've seen this movie or if you watch it after this recommendation, I would love to know what you think of it. Let us know on the Horror Weekly Facebook page. You can either message the page or you can tag it or drop a comment under a post. Tag the page so I'll get a notification. You can do it under any post. It doesn't matter. There's so much discussion going on there. It'll be no one will notice that something off topic shows up. So that's it for this week's episode. We'll see you next Wednesday. Until then, have a great horror week.